This particular subject is entitled Geocide, Genocide, Phytocide, and Soocide, which means the destruction, really, of soil, people, plants, and animals. I am very distressed and have been for a long time about what's happening to these things. And so I'm going to take them sort of in sequence, but not alphabetically, because I'll finish off and spend the most time on genocide and talk about holocausts. But we'll start with soil. In my undergraduate days, I was very interested in this, and almost, as I told some of you, went into agronomy and soil. It was a great interest to me. And what has happened to much of many places in the world, including the United States, and I'll stay pretty much with it, it's bad news. It's very bad news. There were surveys, as I recall, in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Tennessee, in studies to assess the loss of topsoil, especially in areas where it's sloping soil and row crops. And the losses in Iowa, I think, 8 to 13, up to 20 tons per acre per year. Somewhat similar and sometimes higher in Wisconsin and Tennessee. In some place in Iowa, it got up to 50 tons per acre. Now, in our particular area, in the Palouse area, Palouse country, where it's very hilly, as I've told some of you about Pullman, it's one of the few places where you go out walking at night around the block and it's uphill all the way. it's that kind of country. Well, the losses are as high as 50 to 100 tons per acre there. Now, but you have to have something to refer that to. And it has been estimated by some people that if you're losing more than 5 to 8 tons of topsoil per year, it's not consistent with permanent agriculture. Now that's very bad news. And so much of what I'm talking about today, we're losing it. In some other places, we're losing it even worse. Some of those of you who've been in Africa and other places, where at one time, I don't believe in having colonies at all, but they'd learned to till around the hill, and then they started tilling up and down the hill, and it's a terrible loss of soil. So we are in trouble on our soil, and if you lose your soil, we're in deep trouble. However, there is a little good news in some parts. In the Farm Bill of 85, it was regarded as the first time our farm programs rewarded conservation and penalized resource exploitation. What it did, there was a couple of conservation aspects to it. One of them was denied farm benefits, including price supports, disaster payments, and crop insurance to farmers who convert highly erodible land to cropland. And we've done too much of this, where we till soil that shouldn't probably be tilled. And this was called the sodbuster provision. And it classified lands as highly erodible, which, and hear this, 650 million acres. That's a lot of land. Owners who used highly erodible land for crops then had, they could not be penalized from 1980 to 85, but they would be required to begin federally approved conservation measures by 1990 and have them fully implemented by 1995. A companion animal section was dubbed the Swamp Buster provision, will similarly deny benefits to farmers who fill natural wetlands for crop production. So that's a pretty, at least a step in the right direction. And they also have, for fragile land, that's land that's already under high erosion, or it's highly erodible. They're going to take and reimburse this, take out 40 to 45 million acres out of production. And they're also going to, on marginal land, encourage less intensive purposes such as growing trees and grass. And hopefully thus save the topsoil. And they're investing about $40 to $50 per acre in this, which happens to be less than it often costs to keep land in federally subsidized crop production. So at least we're making some steps to do this, but we have to do it in many more places. So much for geocide. The next one, let's talk about phytocide, the destruction of plants. And you should be concerned, as I am concerned, about the loss of rainforest, tropical forest. We're losing it presently at the rate of about the size of West Virginia every year. I suppose we've lost about half of it now. And it's converted, of course, to maybe for production cattle, but it only lasts a little while because it's a very fragile soil. So we lose it. And it's our most productive land from the standpoint of biomass, but also for animal life. And this is a crisis. It really is a crisis. And the sad part of it is most people don't realize it. It is probably contributing to the heating of the earth. A lot of us talked about this a long time ago, and it appears now to be real. I mean, more people in high places are realizing that we are in deep trouble from the standpoint of the so-called greenhouse effect. And this concerns me very much, even though I probably won't be here to witness the worst part of it. But we have to be concerned about future generations. I was early on consulting in the area of aerospace, first in non-manned space flight, and then in manned space flight, and then in space laboratories. And I was not a great proponent of manned space flight, partially because of the expense. And now, of course, we're talking about putting billions and billions of dollars into going to Mars. And I think we got our priorities in setting them wrongly. It's going to be tremendously expensive, but I'm here to tell you that there are probably about 1.5 million, maybe 1.7 million species identified and studied in this planet. We don't really know how many species there are of plants and animals. It's variously estimated at 10 to 30 million, of which we know nothing about. And people can tell you, well, we've lost this many species, and we have lost a lot of species. We're losing species every day. But we can't really quantitate it because we don't know what we got. There's a lot of stuff out there that could really help a lot of things. There's indications that there's material out there that's probably thousands of times sweeter than the sugar we have, probably healthier, probably other sources of protein. The varied species, it's very important to have a variation in species, and we're killing them off. And I think instead of investing so much in what's going on in Mars, we first ought to find out what's here. Now, I guess I could be condemned for provincialism or something, but it just makes sense to me that we ought to define what we have here before we look at something as formidable as Mars. Let the Russians do it. Well, they'd be well, they'd be well informed to study what they have too before they lose it. And in this regard, relative to a summary, fellow Brian Norton, he says, to fail to act decisively and quickly now would be to commit a double arrogance. The first arrogance is directed toward all future generations. It is for us to claim the right to decide for all times which species will be available for our offspring to use and to love. The second arrogance is directed more widely at life itself. Other species are our fellow travelers in a great adventure. If we have any claim to greatness, we will imitate Noah and take the fellow travelers along in the continuing adventure instead of plundering them. That's my words, plundering them. So that's that. Now, on mammalian species especially, but other species too, we have a lot of animals on the endangered species list. A lot of the cats. Here in our own country, we have a very poor record on this. Buffalo, for example, how many millions did we have? Maybe 60 million. Got down to 600. A lot of it just reckless slaughter. And this is happening to quite a number of other species. And we don't seem to care. And we gotta start caring. So that takes care of three of them. We only have one to go. And that's a tough one. And I'll tell you why I talk about it. For one thing, I can see in my mind's eye today, as if I saw this person yesterday, who was one of the victims of the German Holocaust. Holocaust of the Third Reich. As we used to say, he's dead, but he didn't have sense enough to lay down. A walking dead. And I saw him in my last days of prison camp. He came to our camp. I don't know how he made it. But that isn't the only reason. It just stays in my mind and bothers me a lot. I was not long ago, well, it's been a few years now, I guess, I ride to a lot of airports in limousines. And this was a large city, I think it might have been in the Southwest. And I was the only one on the limousine. And it was a college student driving the limousine. And when there's only one, I usually engage him in conversation, which I did. And I don't know how he got off on the subject. The subject got to, on Hitler. And he really didn't know who Hitler was. And then I read of a survey in Seattle, Washington, of high school students, where they asked them what the Holocaust was. And many of them answered it was a Jewish festival. Then I knew we were really in trouble. Then in my book I carry about several things, three of which I may refer to today. The first one is from a teacher who survived the Holocaust of the Third Reich. My eyes saw what no person should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers, children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot by high school and college graduates. Some of the babies, they threw them up in the air for target practice. In suspicion, I'm suspicious of education. My request is to help your students to be human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, or educated Eichmanns. Now, a lot of people speak of the Holocaust. There are a lot of Holocausts. They're still going on. And I'll just recall a few of them for you that I've written down here. And some of you probably saw it in the papers in California a while back when they were having some kind of a celebration. And Duke Majan, who is an Armenian, got wicked off with the head shed in Washington because they did not recognize the Armenian genocide, which happened in World War I, continued into early 20s, where they killed probably at least 1.5 million Armenians. And then in more recent times, Cambodia, 1975 to 79. I have a Norwegian cousin who's a physician, who some people regarded went bad and married a Swede, but he works with Swedes. But he met his wife, really, who was a Swedish nurse in Africa where they were on medical mission. And he's now just finished up his second time in Cambodia helping children as a physician. Now there's some things I suppose he couldn't tell me, but and we'll probably never know how many Cambodians in the killing fields of Cambodia were killed, but there was a very large number, variously estimated from many thousands up to as high as 3.3 million by the Khmer Rouge. It was really terrible. And then in Ethiopia, and it continues today, one of our students is a veterinarian, he and his wife, who is also a veterinarian, are over there in trying to help them out. But they have the Eritreans and the Tigrayans, you've probably heard of them, and it's bad news. They've killed a lot of them. They wanted to move them out of an area into another area. Not that it was better for them, but it was a way to control them because they were giving them a bad time. Or you can go to Afghanistan, or the Tibetans, or the mosquitoes in Nicaragua. All people who have been subjected to in one form or another, genocide. And our hands aren't clean either. We've pretty much taken care of a lot of Indians, a lot of Native Americans. And it continues. But the one we'll dwell on most, it's one I know most about. There have been probably 200 books written about the German Holocaust. Auschwitz is one I know a good deal about. And a lot of people wonder, you know, why didn't they realize this was going on? They built it was originally for very bad prisoners, and then they expanded it and organized it. And there has never been a Holocaust that was so well orchestrated. I mean, their efficiency knew no bounds. I mean, it was fantastically efficient. The trains had to run on time. If you're going to kill 12 million and process and polish off 12,000 a day, you've got to have a pretty good plan for it, which they did have. And the trains would come in, and the people getting off, of course, were felt pretty good about it because here was an ambulance with a big Red Cross on it. It was well landscaped, rather an attractive place. And what they didn't know, they'd take them up in lines and they'd make decisions of which way you went, whether you were going to work or whether this was your last day on earth. Whenever you're a prisoner of war, as I was, as these were, whenever you moved, you were taking into de-lousing in the shower. Well, that's what these people thought they were going into. But it was really a gas chamber. And that ambulance out there was the thing that carried the gas, the poisoned gas. And they'd separate off families and they'd take away everything. of any memento or anything you'd value to completely make you essentially a non-entity. And then they'd work you very hard. In reality, they were also building a large hydrocarbon plant there, both petrochemicals and other things. But you were, the people at work were put out to do this work, and the factories paid a minimum wage for this, which the SS troopers kept. The people never saw it, to my knowledge. It was a terrible situation. And there were very few uprisings. Those who, of course, were involved in this usually ended up as dead in very short order. We kept track of this. That is, our intelligence services and flyovers taking pictures. A lot of people said, "Well, why don't you just bomb the place?" What they did bomb were, as soon as they finished the factories, that was in about 1944 or 1945, they did bomb the factories, so I don't think that some of the more important factories were ever utilizable. And then as the war was coming to a close, they became very concerned in some of the prison camps, and they started to erase the evidence. But they were generally unsuccessful in this. And I recommend some books. A Search for Meaning, for example, is a remarkable book to discuss this, as others, if you're interested, and I can give you some references. The total number of people killed was probably about 7 million in the various countries. The majority, the biggest number were in Poland. The Jewish people suffered the greatest loss. Percentage-wise of the number of people, probably the Gypsies wiped out about, I suppose, various estimates, 500,000 or something of the Gypsies. What they were doing is essentially taking care of the so-called not only non-Aryans, but the people that weren't sort of first-class people. And they were building up in Auschwitz, and they had three different camps, as I recall. They were building, and it was a very big operation. And they were planning then, when they polished off the Jews, to take care of the Poles and the Czechoslovakians. And this was in their long-term plan. Now, another thing, other people did some very bad things about this time too. When the Russians were coming, and they came to Warsaw, a general in the underground there, whose name just escaped me at this moment, figured, well, with the Russians coming, they'll help them out, and they'll start an uprising in Warsaw. Well, what happened was that the Russians, when they started in, they just stopped outside, didn't do anything about it, and waited for the Germans to pretty much polish them off. If you're going to take over a country, you don't want a bunch of tigers out there kicking up dust. And the general and most of his troops, so a few of them escaped through the sewers, but it was very bad news. Another thing that I was questioned on, and the people before me who got in prison camp before me, were also questioned on this. In fact, some of my associates, future associates, before I got to the camp in Poland, had been taken by the Germans to the Katyn Forest massacre site, which they controlled at that time. It was in Russia. And the Germans were trying to, in fact, the Germans, when I was captured, saying, you know, you as the United States and the advanced people, how can you tie up with allies with such, with a bunch of terrible people like the Russians who committed all kinds of atrocities? And what they did, they took these American officers who were captured to this site to prove to them that these 10,000 people in this mass grave, they were the officer corps of the Polish army who they had captured. They were in a mass grave. I think their hands had been wired behind their back. Many of them had a mouthful of sawdust and were shot at short range in the back of the head, as I recall. And as much as one of the fellows I knew best said, as much as I don't want to believe it, I have to admit that they got a case for this, that the Russians really did this. And of course, when the Russians recaptured this, they had their own show. But it did come out, of course, at the end of the war, that the Russians, in fact, had did this mass execution of the corps, really, of the Polish officer corps. And if you're going to control a country, that's a good way to start if you don't want a lot of trouble, to polish off the officer corps, which they did. And of course, they also compromised many other people. One that really cut me up, because I know several people from there, is Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, who are sort of non-entities as people now, and are very sad people. And if you know any of them, if you start talking to them about it, it doesn't take them long to start crying for what has happened there. So it isn't good news. And what really bothers me too about this is that some people don't believe it ever happened. In fact, there's many of them are essentially ignoring that this happened, and they're rewriting their history and saying it didn't really happen. And here in this country, you recall, there was a fellow who said nothing like this happened, and he in fact made an award, said if they can prove that it really happened. And this fellow essentially did prove it, and then they refused to pay, and he sued and did win. But this goes on. And one of the reasons that I work in Amnesty International is because so much, so many terrible things happen in torture today. And I'm going to read you something about that. I haven't done this a lot here. I did it once many years ago around this fireplace, and told about some of the things that happened, and some people couldn't stand it. And we often wonder, you know, what can you do about this? What could the people in Germany have done about this? Didn't they know about it, you see? And I think it was, wasn't that Niemöller who said, he was a German submarine captain in the First World War, became a theologian. And he said, you know, when they came for the Jews, I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't raise my voice. And then they came for the labor unions, the people in the labor movement, and I wasn't in that, so I didn't raise my voice. And then they came for the Catholics, and I wasn't a Catholic, so I didn't raise my voice. And then when they came for me, there wasn't anybody to raise their voice. So what do we do about it? Well, I guess first of all, you got to recognize the problem. A friend of mine is Janetta Sagan. She was tortured. Her family was essentially wiped out. And she was the co-founder of Amnesty International. She lives in southern, in the Bay Area, near Palo Alto. Her husband is a very good friend of mine. He works in Palo Alto Clinic, as I recall, and works for EPRI, Electric Power Research Institute, a physician. She is a remarkable woman who is working hard throughout the world to help people who are in trouble. And she says every day she's thankful she can see the light of day and welcome each day when it comes and work in her garden. And then she always thinks of those who can't. The present president, oh, there was one other thing I was going to bring to your attention. That was that I've also been following because I collect all this material. This was in last week's Wall Street Journal. Iraq's Kurds received welcome in Turkey despite old animosities. And I don't know if you know anything about the Kurds. They extend in Iraq, Iran, and into Turkey. And sort of nobody wants them. And they're trouble for them because they want to be independent. 4,000 of desperate Kurds, the exodus from Iraq and the horror of death by chemicals end here in the refugee camps in Turkey. Turkey, which for hundreds of years has resisted the idea of a Kurdish nation, is welcoming and sheltering the refugees. They promise to impose a heavy political and economic burden on Turkey. It increases with each cattle truck grinding to a halt to unload its bedraggled human cargo here. The refugees have lost their guns, but not their will to fight. Some 10,000 are here inside a tent. A dozen men in guerrilla khaki insist that it was a barrage of chemical bombs dropped by the Iraqi Air Force that drove them from their homes in Iraq. We are Peshmerga, that is, forward to death fighters, said this 30-year-old. We'll only stop fighting when they have finished off the entire Kurdish nation, vows another one, recalling the execution of women in his village. We're ready to fight another 100 years. Just as it appeared that Iraq and Iran might be ending their 8-year-old war, finally bringing peace to this region, Iraq has started yet another war against its own Kurdish minority. Despite official denials, Iraq appears to be using poison gas on the Kurds, just as it did against the Iranians, further raising the risk that chemical warfare will become routine in third world conflict. And you see, that's a cheap way to go, isn't it? If you're a third world, you can put together a laboratory and produce nerve gases pretty easy. And that's a terrible way to go. I don't know if any of you have been exposed to gases, but in our training in the Army, we'd be exposed to certain gas, like tear gas. Just that in itself is very terrible. But they have a lot better ones now. Or I should say a lot worse ones. For hundreds of years, the Kurds have struggled to establish an independent Kurdistan in the territories that I've just named. Like the Palestinians, the world's 20 million Kurds share a religion, a culture, a language, and a passion for autonomy. Nearly half live in Turkey, which refuses even to recognize them as a distinct national minority. See, they're five times higher population than the Palestinians. But we don't hear much about them. They're not referred to as Kurds in Turkey, they're referred to as Mountain Turks. So the Kurds outnumber the Palestinians, as I mentioned to you. With all its economic troubles and its fear of Kurdish nationalism, Turkey can hardly afford to offer the Iraqi Kurds a permanent home. Yet failing to offer them sanctuary would undermine the Prime Minister of Turkey's position. He's carefully cultivating an image of a defender of human rights. Turkey's reputation in this area is a source of concern to the government. Turkey aims to establish itself as a first-class citizen of the world in all respects. Delivering the hostile Kurds to Iraq's Iranian enemy would also jeopardize Turkey's role as a friend to both nations. So she's sitting between a rock and a couple of hard places. It's only a fragile ceasefire between Iran and Iraq. How can we transfer the combat potential of these guerrillas from one country to another without approval from Iraq? So it's a very, very difficult problem. A little more than 2 weeks ago, 60,000 to 100,000 Iraqi Kurds have walked across the mountains to Turkey. You're talking about a lot of people, you see. No one in the region disputes the accounts of gassing. Even the birds were falling from the sky, they said. We have seen the burned faces and the arms. These people are here to lick their wounds and then return to fight. Turkey says it has no definitive evidence that chemical weapons were used. The horror of the refugee reports led the U.S. Senate to vote last Friday to impose economic sanctions against Iraq until it stops using poisonous gases and ceases the campaign of genocide. Now, I've surveyed a lot of people ask me, you know, did they really torture you or punish you in any way? Well, they threatened, but for me, they never really laid a hand on me. But we had to be careful. In fact, we got into trouble. You had to realize that that if you took in livestock of any sort, that was capital punishment. And one of our associates got in trouble in that. We had to buy them all. I didn't have any compunction. I trained quite a few people to milk cows. At night, when they were in March, we'd sneak in and milk the cows. Caused a lot of commotion because they had a certain quota to fulfill. And if you milked a lot of cows in the middle of the night, they didn't make their quota. They took offense at that. But they scared us, but never carried through. Although, of course, at the end of the war, Hitler did put out the order that all prisoners of war would be shot. The church services were well attended that next Sunday in our prison camp. Now, I'm going to read you, I think, something important. As you know, the Amnesty International was awarded a Nobel Prize some years ago. We stand at and this is the president now speaking, this is an excerpt from his speech to the Commonwealth Club of California. We stand at a unique moment in history because average, decent people in the world can now make a difference in human rights. Although the power of governmental police forces is immense, the greater power is that of people who merely use their pens and their telexes and their telegrams. And surprisingly, against all that immense governmental power, individual men and women are becoming the conscience of the world. You and I must increasingly organize ourselves against a world that sees one-third of the governments of the world torturing its own citizens every day. One-third. Tens of thousands of political prisoners in jails today are screaming out for our attention. Their plight reflects the violations of both our enemies and our friends. The East and the West, the North and the South, the rich and the poor countries throughout the world all share a record of human degradation in their jails. Why is it that our friends and our allies share in common the determination to hurt their own people and to use their own power against their own citizens? Where lies the conscience of the world to stop it, to organize it, to mobilize against it? Tens of thousands of lonely people who have an opinion to tell or a creed to express are sitting in stinking, lousy jails all over the world. They cry out to you and to me, let me out, let my children out. We take the human rights to fight to those governments that oppress their own people. We embarrass them. We bring the public light upon their human rights violations, and we force them in moral outrage to let their people go. Why can't we rid the world of torture the way we rid the world of slavery? Today, in country after country, the power of the state reaches into the very soul of their people to destroy them. You've not ever heard of war until you've talked to torture victims about what people can do to other people. They'll put a rat on a person's stomach and a helmet over the rat, and then they'll heat the helmet so the rat has to exit through the victim's body. Under President Marcos in the Philippines, they used chainsaws to cut off the heads of people to terrorize the villagers. The Soviets stick chemicals into the veins of the best and the brightest scientists to stop human rights activity. And as Emily said, told about sleep the other day, one of the techniques during the Korean conflict, assuming you know, and for the Chinese captures. I mean, one of the things you can really mess up a person, and in fact you can drive them crazy, is just deny them their sleep and their toilet privileges. That'll fix you. It's like it fixed a lot of people. Iran forces the family of children they killed to pay for the bullets for the execution of their own children. Chile will pick up people and torture them over the weekend and then throw them out in the street on Monday morning so that groups like Amnesty International don't have time to respond. In Chile, they doused a kid with gasoline and set him on fire. How dare they? Who among us wants to stand for this outrage when you can do something about it? Today in the Republic of South Africa, tens of thousands of children sit in their jails simply because they are black. Human rights violations don't go away. And when you hear about human rights violations getting better in some countries, be suspicious. Be suspicious because they can kill enough people that the fear is so intense and so immense that nobody dares to speak out. No one dares to leave their home at night for fear the government soldiers are on the move. Government should be in the business of protecting the people. That's not what they're for. That's what they're for. That's why the United Nations was founded. But where do the people go for help when they suffer these human rights violations? That's what Amnesty International is concerned with. Governments to protect themselves and tenaciously hold on to their power, define someone in their midst as a lesser person. And that lesser person might one day be a Shiite, the next day a Sufi, the next day a Green, the next day an Orange, the next day a Jew, the next day a Palestinian, the next day a Malay, the next day a Chinese. They'll find any reason to put a lesser person in jail and torture him. And every time they do so, you and I and all decent people on earth will stand up and say nobody should be tortured ever by anybody. So the single standard of human rights is so important. When we address human rights violations in the Eastern Bloc, our government cheers us on. But when we investigate the Philippines and South Korea, this was a couple of years ago, the friends of the United States, then the U.S. government gets indigestion. They ask us about the timing of our reports. They ask, is this true? But they never ask us about Eastern Europe and the criticism we have there. Why is it there's a certain glee of certain human rights in one part of the world, but a certain indigestion, but the same kind of human rights violations in other regions of the world? I believe it's because we lack a single standard for human rights. We must remind governments throughout the world, there is no lesser person in this earth. There is none. There never has been and there never will be. In our work, we don't want to become historians of the human rights movement, but we need instead to stop the abuse of creating a people's movement. If no one else is going to do it, then it's got to be us. and we find very effective ways to do so. In one given year, out of a group of 5,000 prisoners we have docked, about 1,400 will be freed. So when we see how possible it is, we can say to people that they can make a moral response to human rights abuse by simply writing a letter. What they do at Washington State, they have a group and meet periodically. And you sit down and you have the letters that you have to write. And it's usually to the leaders of those countries. You never write to your own country. You always write to some other country. We have a mechanism called urgent action, and if you telegram within 72 hours of pickup, we can deliver enough volume to that jail that it'll save a person 50% of the pain and torture. Who is Amnesty? You are and we are. I wish that all the prisoners in the world today could stand up and know we are here and that we are cheering for them. We want to get to the next torture and to let them know that we want to know the tortured's name. And we want to reach the parents and the grandparents of that torture victim. We want to help them and to touch them and not let the embarrassment of torture, which cuts into the fabric of the community, leave a toxic poison in the system. We know that for the rest of their lives, the torture victims must face themselves in the agony that they cannot bring back their psyche. And so oftentimes they execute themselves, not even knowing why they executed themselves. The United States has a long, deep sense of justice. But justice, like anything else, must be contained and watched and seen from all around the world. Justice is only justice if it's for everyone. And as we struggle within the human rights movement to help all people of our mandate, we need your help. We need your strength. We need your might. Let us work together to remove torture from the earth. Let us free all the political prisoners and let nobody die. Now, just in, and we'll leave it open for a discussion, but I want to tell you about what happened in the Third Reich of so-called lesser persons. One of my more interesting visits, more memorable visits, was the day and night, and part of another day I spent at Beto in Bielefeld, West Germany. Now, I was interested in it for several reasons. One of the great, many great supporters of Holden are the Hongs, Howard and Edna Hong. Edna Hong has many books that are bestsellers. One of the ones that impressed me remarkably was Bright Valley of Love, which was about Beethoven. She went there and seen it. And what attracted me, among other things, was they happened to mention animals there, which of course raises my antenna. And also, we did have later, Carolyn Meredith Hinby went over there, but we had Alex Funky, who was then the director, came here to the village. He has some really outstanding tapes here about Beethoven. And we compared notes, and he invited me to come and visit him. You see, he was a prisoner of war in the United States when I was a prisoner of war in Germany. And he acknowledged he had the best deal. And he did. And he ran a remarkable ship there in Beethoven. I should tell you a little bit about it. Beethoven started in 1867 when some Christians in Westphalia decided that attics and back rooms were not the appropriate place to keep people. So they brought him in to live with them in the city, or in a place called Beethoven in Bielefeld. And it's called an institution without walls. I helped the Latham Foundation with a film about that. It's called Institution Without Walls, about how animals help the people there. So in one of my consultations to the U.S. Air Force Surgeon General, I took the weekend off and went out to Beethoven, about an hour's ride, train ride, down to from Hanover, as I recall, south and west. First, I should give you a little background, though. Father Bodelschwing, who was one of the, I guess, one of the first permanent directors of this place, was a minister, and he was pastoring, or as a sort of a chaplain, to many of the Germans who were at that time doing a lot of the scut work in the city of Paris. And then he got this call to go to Basel. And within a few weeks, all four of his children died. And a fellow came to him, I think a pastor, and said, God will give you back four children. I imagine it was hard for him to believe that. But he did go to Beethoven, and he was a genius in many ways. He started in 1871 and expanded the operation, got a lot of farms. He took over some land that wasn't doing anything and realized that he had to get drainage in it and break through the sort of a hard pan layer, and became very productive. And it became a remarkable operation. He did have four more children, and the day or two after the fourth one was born, this fellow who had seen him many years before and said, God will replace your children, showed up. And he was there until 1911, when his son Fritz replaced him. Remarkable fellow. What I saw when I came there was a remarkable facility. Facilities. If you have 5,000 disadvantaged persons and over 5,000 who take care of them in some of the most modern facilities and research and everything else, you got a big operation. Many farms. Took me out to some of the farms where they had many animals. And I was truly impressed with it. And Alex Funke said, as I understand my mission here, is that all of those who come here must come to realize that God loves them. And essentially everybody has to do some kind of work, no matter what, how simple it is. And most of them do. And there's all kinds of classes of people there. And they took me around, and it was very obvious. They took me around the various facilities, and I was in House Ebenezer. And I'd been up looking at the facilities, and as we came down, people had been eating, and they came out of the dining room. And one person caught my eye. He was laying in a gurney and boxing gloves on. He grimaced when he made all kinds of funny grimaces in his face. And it was obviously that they wanted me to meet him. And before we got there, he shouted out, "Who's that coming?" And they told him it was an American, and he became very excited about this. And because Americans had come there and helped him a good deal. And then I was introduced to him. His name was Rickard. And he had a lot of questions for me. He found out I was a veterinarian, and then he really got excited. He wondered if we ever work on birds who have broken wings. How do you give therapy to fish? And so it went. And then he asked me if we ever employed any Indians in our College of Veterinary Medicine. And I says we did. I wasn't sure whether he wanted Native Americans or Indians from India. But we had both, so I figured I could say yes. And then we said goodbye. And I left with my guest, and my host, rather. And I asked him, it was an unusual question that he asked me about Indians. Did he mean Native Americans, which were very popular at that time in West Germany, or did he mean Indians from India? No, he says he meant Indians from India because he's very interested in Indians from India. In fact, he supports some children there. One of them is now studying to be a teacher. And I says, well, here's a fellow. He was then about 50 years old, I guess. I says, this guy's been here since he was 7. And he's been flapping his back all this time. He has no control over his muscles. He's epileptic. Well, he's a cerebral palsy. And he says, yeah, what I didn't tell you is that he has control of his right foot. And some years ago, he learned to paint with his right foot, with mirrors. And he paints very beautiful pictures, which we sell and cut them up in the cards. I have several of them. And he sells them, and all the money goes to help these children in India. And I have a picture of Rickard on my wall, and some of his pictures. And if I think I got problems, I really don't have problems. Now, I've corresponded with Rickard in all the years since, until this last year when I got word that he had died. His birthday was in July. He was probably almost 60. But the story doesn't end there. Because Rickard lived through some very difficult times. Because, you see, Hitler put out the order that all such people, lesser people, would be put to death. And they started doing it. You had to fill out forms on all such people. Fritz von Bodelschwingh refused to do it. So they came in and did it. He appealed to the high command because these are people, they were his children. He'd worked since 1911. And then the story I have, that he appealed to the high command, he got a letter, unsatisfactory letter back from Goring. And one day, Dr. Brandt, Hitler's personal physician, and some others showed up. Well, they knew they were coming, so they really set up for it. They had some handicapped people playing music as they came up. And Fritz von Bodelschwingh got Brandt off to the side. And he asked him, well, what do you mean by less than human? He says, people who cannot communicate. So he says, I'd like to show you our worst cases. So he took him to the House Patmos, where they had some very severe cases. I don't know all of them. Henrietta, who was hydrocephalic, epileptic, and retarded, asleep when they came in. Von Bodelschwingh went over to her, patted her gently on the head, called her by name. She woke up, saw him, smiled, happy to see him. Then there was Otto, who knew about 3 or 4 things. I had fantastic reaction to colors, bright colors. He really could appreciate bright colors. And von Bodelschwingh never knew anybody that enjoyed food more than him, to watch him eat, which confirms what he said. The patients are the professors, and he learned a lot from these patients, especially in House Patmos. And so he went down the line with these people, and then he finally turned to Dr. Brandt, and he says, I can understand that you may not be able to communicate with these people, but it should be obvious to you that we communicate. And with that, he turned, walked back to headquarters, followed by Dr. Brandt, who, on arriving there, said to his entourage, we have ceased negotiations and are returning to Berlin. I am here to tell you that not one of those people were harmed during the war. But as some of the members of the entourage said when they left, they're certainly not going to get any support from the Third Reich. Well, they hadn't been getting any anyway. But every day there were supplies that showed up on the doorstep. And they were saved because people did not regard these as lesser persons, but they cared about them, gave them compassion. And that's what our assignment is, isn't it? To make judgments on people because they are different from us, to regard them as lesser, reminds me of another story out of Beto. It was a Hilda, I think her name was. And she was what you might call maybe a vegetable. And there was a nurse, a retired nurse, who had taken over. And they have nice kind of living units there. And they kind of put them together sort of as a family. And this lady was in charge of this group. And there were varying kinds of people. And one day she got a letter from Hilda's father. And it says, "I pray every day that God will take Hilda." And this nurse sat down and wrote him immediately a letter back to him. I should tell you that Hilda was essentially, she was laid down, she was prone essentially all the time. A beautiful face and wonderful eyes. A very pretty child, or childlike.